Good afternoon. Our topic this afternoon is deflation, the economics of deflation. This is an important topic, especially in the middle of a financial crisis when deflation threatens for reasons that we will discuss. It is also a contested subject, and main justification, the fight against deflation is one of the main justifications of our present monetary system, which is characterized by two main elements. One is paper money, or fiat paper money, and the other one is central banking. Okay. So the fight against deflation is supposed to be one of the main missions of central banks, and they can accomplish this task with the help of the printing press. So we need to take a closer look at the question whether and to what extent deflation is really detrimental from an overall point of view, and for which groups in particular. So we need to analyze cause and effect as far as deflation is concerned. But maybe let us first start by defining our subject. So what is deflation? Deflation has two main definitions. One is a reduction of the supply of money. And we might add that traditionally, that is, it was the main definition until about World War II. This reduction of the supply of money concerned in particular that part of the money supply that had been artificially increased. So before you had some sort of inflation in the sense of an artificial increase of the money supply, and then what the deflation did was to reduce that part of the money supply that had been artificially reduced, increased. The second definition of deflation, and this is the one that is prevalent today, means by inflation, deflation, sustained decrease of the price level, or the general level of prices. So if there is occasionally one price that diminishes, typically, so in certain industries, the computer industries and so on, prices tend to fall. That is not a deflation, right? We might at best speak of a sectoral deflation, but it's not a decrease of the general level of prices. Okay, what are then the causes and the consequences of deflation? And I will now focus, it's not ultimately important which of these deflations we use. I will use the second one because it's the prevalent one today. Because the causal mechanisms that are here at stake are the same, right? What a definition does is to encircle the phenomenon that you want to discuss. But as far as the causal connections are concerned, you have them, whatever your definition is, right? So I will see in particular that one cause of deflation in the sense of a decrease of the price level is precisely a reduction of the money supply. Okay, so if the causes, now our first cause is the reduction of the money supply. For those of you who have economics classes, well, you know, so this call this MS goes down. Why does this entail a decreased level of prices? Well, because as the money supply shrinks, money becomes relatively scarce as compared to other goods. Therefore, the subjective value of money increases per unit, increases relative to the subjective value of other goods. And therefore, you pay from now on lower quantities of money in exchange for other real goods. And the other way around, if you buy money, that is, if you sell these other goods, you ask for less money than before because it has become relatively scarce, okay, relatively more valuable. So as the money supply shrinks, we get a reduction of the price level. The second cause of deflation is an increase in the demand for money. This little m d, demand for money. And why is it here? Why is it a capital M and here little m? It's this is because the demand for money always concerns the purchasing power. Okay. In economics, M, the capital letters are always symbols for nominal variables. Nominal in the case of money means the amount of physical objects. Right? So, for example, F1. So, with this nice dollar bill, this is a nominal cash balance. This is part of my nominal cash balance, the physical object. Right? Other physical objects that we use as money, we have it at the bank, for example, a bank account is also a nominal cash balance, nominal amount of money, physical object that I hold, that is in my property. And the real cash balance is the purchasing power represented by this object, that is the array of all goods and services that I can buy for $1. Okay, so that is the real balance that I hold. So you see that these two phenomena always go together. It's impossible to hold a nominal balance without holding a real balance at the same time. Right? And the other way around, you cannot hold a real balance without holding a nominal balance. Now, what we demand, the reason why we hold money is only because of its purchasing power. Therefore, we use the small letter here to signify this fact. Right? The demand for money always concerns a certain purchasing power. Few people hold money for money's own sake. Right? We call them the money fetishists, like Scrooge. Right? Scrooge has this entire building full of coins and notes and so on. He likes taking a bath in money. Okay, so Scrooge is a money fetishist. His demand, currency, he likes the physical objects per se. Right? He doesn't care for their purchasing power. He just likes money. Right? Likes. So he would therefore hoard and accumulate it, irrespective of what the purchasing power is. But all people who are not Scrooge, who are not money fetishists, they hold money only to the extent that it provides them with a purchasing power, that it provides them with a very liquid economic good that can be used to make purchases. So everyone holds then a certain amount of purchasing power for to satisfy his daily exchange needs. Right? Well, our demand for money concerns it's a real demand for money. It concerns the purchasing power. It concerns a real cash balance. Now, if our demand for money goes up, what does this mean? Well, it means that money becomes for us more valuable as compared to other goods. Right? So again, we have here a tautological statement saying that the demand for money goes up means that we evaluate money differently as compared to all the other goods that we could also hold. Rather than holding all these billions of dollars in my pocket, I could also hold another car or have another suit or whatever, make a donation, various things. Right? So the fact that I have this money in my pocket proves that this amount of money is more valuable to me at this point of time than all the other things that I could also buy. So if my demand for money increases, it means that additional money becomes more valuable to me than all the other things that I could also buy. So as a consequence, I will render this money, I will sell it only if I can get a higher price in terms of these other goods. Right? Before my increase in the demand for money, I was ready to buy a bread every day for the price of $1. As my demand for money increases, I'm no longer ready to give up my dollar in exchange for the bread. I would be willing to give it up in exchange for two breads, right? So, but then we have, of course, a reduction of prices, of bread prices, right? The bread no longer costs $1, but it costs 50 cents. So demand for money always entails a decreasing price level. Third cause is growth. Real growth, right? We have a growing economy On Monday and Tuesday, we've been talking about this. You had lectures on the subject, and it's the Austrian theory of growth. As we accumulate more capital and can engage in more roundabout production, we can turn out a higher quantity of goods and services per hour worked. Now, if we do not modify the money supply, it means that we are selling now a greater quantity of real goods and services against the same amount of money. That is, all these goods and services relative to money become less scarce. So money relative to them becomes more scarce. Their subjective value falls relative to money. Money's subjective value rises relative to these goods. Okay. As a consequence, again, right, you exchange only a smaller amount for money for a given good. And if you sell the given good, you are happy with a smaller money payment as well. How can this work out? So this is our subject today. How can we have an economy that that grows with the falling price level? Is one of the questions that we have to answer today. In fact, so these are the three main causes of deflation. There are other minor causes of deflation. For example, there could be technical difficulties in the payment system. Imagine, for example, that there was a huge computer bug in the banking industry. So all banks would have to close down for a week or something. So it would mean that less money services, monetary banking services would be available, payments would slow down. As a consequence, we would also have a fall of the price level. Okay? So there are other causes of deflation, but these are the three main ones. What I would do, like to do now is to focus on, so we need now maybe have a closer look at this here, at this process, how growth deflation happens, if deflation is caused by an increasing production, increased productivity of human labor, we speak of a growth deflation. So we'll take a closer look at this and then discuss the further consequences that deflation has on the economy. Okay, so how is it possible that an economy grows when the price level falls? This is paradoxical in the eyes of our Keynesian friends. Also in the eyes of our Keynesian enemies, by the way. And for them, it's inconceivable how a growing economy could entail a lower price level, or how the one could go in hand with the other. Is it not the case that the profitability of any investment depends on the amount of money that I earn? So if the prices fall, my revenue also necessarily falls. And in fact, if I have a deflation, a general decrease of the price level, then necessarily I have reduced revenue, monetary revenue, for more or less all companies in the entire economy. So how is it possible that these companies then increase their output? How is this imaginable? They have reduced income, and so their income falls relative to cost expenditure, so profitability diminishes. That's not a reason to increase your output, rather a reason to close down. Right? So how is this possible? And the answer is that the profitability of any company does not depend on the level of prices, but on relative prices. It depends on the relationship between its revenue and its cost expenditure. This is an arrow. It signifies the passage of time. Okay, so my favorite diagram gets really primitive. Two points of time, an earlier point of time and a later point of time. So we have an initial expenditure here and a later revenue. Oh, this is the European one, okay? It's not 720, it's 120. Doesn't matter. So this is representative for a thriving business. The revenue is higher than the initial expenditure, right? Cost expenditure. And what is characteristic of a bad business, of a business that doesn't go well, is that the revenue is lower than the initial expenditure, right? Then you should consider closing down. Now, the point is, therefore, that a company thrives as a consequence of a spread, positive spread between revenue and expenditure. Whatever the level of prices and whatever the monetary level of expenditure is. Now, let's say, what is the company producing? Maybe it's producing cars. Right, so we have a nice German sport car. It doesn't look like one. So maybe it's a French sport car. Okay. So this times 100, whatever, right? So, and you earn, so 120 units of money, 120,000, 120 million, right? It would be the Italian sports car, 120 million, for 100 cars of this type. And here as your input, right? So we're considering now the physical level, right? So you have people and you have whatever, machines that you use and so on, various physical input. Now, this positive spread can exist at any level, right? For example, if the price level were lower, let's say the price level were 60, and we would only pay 50 for our factors of production, we would have exactly the same profitability. We would have here a gross profit of 20%. So if you can buy these physical things with 50 units of money rather than 100, and you sell them for 60 rather than 120, you're just as well off as in the previous case. And of course, also in the inverse case, that all prices rise. And if prices, let's say, they rise to the level that your total revenue amounts to 240 and you spend 200 on the same physical items, then you're not better off because your revenue, your nominal revenue, is higher. Right?
The higher nominal revenue is in fact the same real revenue because you can still buy only the same goods and services for it.
Okay.
Say it again. That in an inflation?
No. No, it would not. No.
Because the interest rate is in fact are these 20% that we see here, right? So that's so to say the gross interest rate, and we see again then it would be the same, it would again be 20%. So the interest rate can only vary temporally in the process and only under the condition that this adjustment has not been anticipated, which brings us to our point. So we see that in principle the economy can operate at any price level, which concords with what you have learned early in the week, namely that the money supply is irrelevant. Right? The economy can work at any money with any money supply at any level of expenditure. But how does the process work if we go from here to there? That is, if we have a growing economy and we need to get from this level to this new level. And the answer is, in one word, expectations, or also say anticipation, entrepreneurial anticipations. Because this year, what we represent by an arrow and a couple of figures, is not something that springs into reality by an act of nature. It doesn't fall from the blue sky. It is brought into being by a human being who is thinking, right? Who is working for a market that will exist only in the future. Our entrepreneur is acting here, he's buying here factors of production, having in mind that he will probably obtain 120 units revenue in the future. Right? And in this case here, so if it, in fact he will obtain the 120 in the future, he has succeeded, everything has worked out fine. Right? So we need always to keep in mind that the choice, the crucial choice, is made at this point of time. At point of time one, we don't really know what's going on. At point of time two, we're working toward this reality, right? And paying the prices now for the factors of production in view of those prices that we expect for the future. So the only question then is, does our entrepreneur anticipate the fall of prices? That's the only question, right? And then, of course, in the market economy, there's no necessity that they do. Of course, they can be wrong about this, but they can just as well be right. They can also overestimate the fall of prices. Maybe our entrepreneur will think the price, that his revenue will only be 50. In fact, it will be 60. So the point, the difficulty is not the evolution of the price level. It's not even the evolution of his individual revenues and so on. The only question is, does he correctly anticipate it? And the likelihood that he correctly anticipates this is not higher, neither is it lower, in an environment in which the price level falls than it is in an environment in which the price level rises or remains stable. Okay? Entrepreneurs have to anticipate correctly their revenue in the future. The quality of their judgment, the question, do they correctly anticipate it or not, their success is not more likely if the prices remain stable than when prices rise or when prices diminish. Okay? So, to the extent that entrepreneurs anticipate the fall of prices, what will they do? Well, they will start saying to the owners of these things, that is to the people themselves and to the owners of these machines, so, listen guys, we have a great party in the past and so on, we had a great time, but I mean, we won't be able to sell our stuff for this price, right? So we need to go down or we need to close shop. These are the only options that are open to us. Now there are two possibilities. Either these guys find somebody else who pays them more, right? So then our entrepreneur, then they will go, let's say, work for 80 units of money for somebody else, and he needs to close shop, and he will close shop. Or they do not find anybody else who pays more. And that's exactly what happens in an environment in which all prices fall. If all prices fall, then more or less all companies are confronted to lower monetary revenue in the future. So no entrepreneur will pay higher prices for these factors of production, and they therefore, have to agree to this lower payment. So the economy will work and will adapt to this decreasing price level, to this deflation. Oh, of course, it's costly for you to wait if you have competitors who are ready to occupy your market, right? So you can do that. I mean, you cannot just out of personal whim say, well, now I'm deciding not to produce anymore. But then you risk that somebody else will show up, hire your people, and then surf the market, and they will do it. Right? So this is not very likely to happen. Right? So it's, what will happen is exactly this. And then, of course, it's something that we cannot don't have to discuss in more detail, right? We can discuss various cases. That's what I do for my students always in the classroom, that we just discuss all the various cases, all the errors that they can make. They can overshoot or undershoot and so on. But it boils down to this. What really drives this process is only the expectations of the entrepreneur. If the entrepreneurs anticipate correctly this movement of a falling price level, which they eventually will, right, then they can thrive, they can operate profitably in this environment because they just diminish also the payments for the factors of production. And the factor owners will agree to these reductions in payments because there's nobody who offers them anymore. And second, because even accepting the lower nominal payment, they are in real terms just as well off and even better off than before, right? Because this lower number 50 stands in the same relationship to this number 60 here as the 100 to the 120. That is, their monetary revenue as compared to the price level of the product is exactly the same as before. Plus, we need to consider that we have here real growth. That is, at the lower price level, we have actually a higher physical output. Right? It's not the same amount of cars that we sell. There is a one or two cars extra. Okay, so the consumers, that is the factor owners, will actually have a higher real income, even though their nominal income has fallen.
Yeah. I've heard a few people argue that in an environment of like falling.
Yeah, well, that's plain wrong, right? And for the reason that I've given you, what is relevant is not the level of revenue, but only profitability. That's the only criterion. Yeah. And your profitability can be high. Can grow, can increase, can decrease, whatever the level of prices, whatever the evolution of the level of prices, has nothing to do.
We started to have sound money tomorrow.
Right. Many of them would go bankrupt because they don't adjust quickly enough, right? But from an aggregate point of view, that is not a big problem, right? Thank you very much, sir. We'll come to this problem, okay? So that's the general. Right? That's the general mechanism, right? So we see the causal connections that are here at work. The core causal factor is expectations. Only the quality of expectations drives the adjustment of the economy, whatever the level of prices, whatever the level of revenue. So the price level per se is not causally related to economic growth. The economy can grow whatever evolution the price level takes. Now, let's go into the complications. And we come to debt. Right? So this process that I've described here is certainly characteristic for an economy that would be financed predominantly or wholly by equity. That is, in which the firms are completely owned by the entrepreneurs. They don't operate with debt. Now, there are problems that come into place as soon as companies are predominantly or totally financed with debt. And we'll see that this problem is indeed one that that plays out on a micro level, but from an aggregate point of view, it does not. So it would be a fallacy of composition, right, to generalize the difficulties that can emerge on the level of individual firms for the overall operation of for individual entrepreneurs for the overall operation of the economy. So let's suppose that, for example, would be an individual company and that the investment of 100 had been financed completely by debt. And what the debt might be 1,000 units of money with a debt service of 2%. Okay, can you read this red stuff? Okay, so 1,000 units of money at 2%. Right, so it's been taking place. So 2% of 1,000 is 20 units of money. So we have this difference here, 120 minus 100 is 20. So the ongoing operation of this company churns out just enough monetary revenue to serve the debt. Now, what happens if the price level falls? The company can again be profitable, right? It expends 50 and the revenue is 60, but the absolute revenue now is only 10, it's no longer 20. In real terms, of course, nothing has changed. the 10 units that of monetary revenue have the same purchasing power and even a higher purchasing power than the 20 units before. But the debt was contracted in nominal terms. You are obliged to pay back 1,000 units. You're not obliged to pay back a certain purchasing power unless you have made contractual provisions. Right? So in this case, then, the company is bankrupt. It can no longer serve the debt. And more precisely, our entrepreneur, the one who contracted the debt, he is bankrupt. Now, there are exactly two solutions for this problem. Two and only two solutions. And a combination thereof. The first one is that our guy goes bankrupt. Okay? Consequence, the debt disappears. Okay? That's one great thing about bankruptcy. The debt disappears. And the company is taken over by the creditors. Those guys who have given him the money, who cannot get their money back. And this is very important. The physical production structure, the company itself, the people it employs, the machinery and so on, all the know-how that is involved, except even the know-how of the guy who was running it, if he was running it, not only being an owner but also a manager, all this still exists. The company has only a new owner. That is, it's not because we have a bankruptcy that this is the end of the world. It's not even the end of the world for the company. And the people least affected in the medium and long run are the employees. In the short run, of course, they might be affected. They might be laid off temporarily, so there's a loss of revenue and so on. Right? But in the long run, they are least affected. They still have their jobs, whereas the guy who was the entrepreneur, the nominal owner, he's no longer the owner. There are new owners. So from the point of view of society, it's of course irrelevant who is the owner of a company. Right? What is important is that production goes on and that consumers are being served. It's not important who owns these things, right? From an aggregate point of view, from an overall point of view. So all that inflation does in this worst of all cases is that there's a switch of owners. And if there's still a positive spread between revenue and cost level, the company can operate just as before, and it will operate just as before, will be continued just as before. Second solution is that the debt will be renegotiated. So you say, okay, Jack or whatever the name is of the bankrupt entrepreneur, you say, well, Jack, now, okay, you cannot serve 1,000, so we write down 500 of this. Now you own us only 500, and it's still 2%. 500 at 2% is, of course, 10 units of money. So it's exactly a credit that he can serve at this lower level of revenue. Okay? Which of the two solutions will be chosen depends on the particular circumstances of each case. Right? The second solution, renegotiation of debt, is likely to come into existence if the present management is particularly efficient. That is, if the creditors have the impression, well, we could not substitute any more efficient people for them. And only if they think, well, these guys are really complete zeros, everybody else realized that the price level was falling and they were still operating as in the good old times, we don't want them, we need to put in somebody new, then they would let the whole company, the old owners, go bankrupt and put a new team in place. Right? So there would be, these would be the main considerations. So deflation is therefore never a problem from an economic point of view. Even in the worst of all cases, you get a hiccup. Can be a major hiccup if there are many bankruptcies at the same time, but it's not something that prevents the operation of the market economy. Market economy can thrive in a deflationary environment. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, as you have said, I mean, if this is eaten then out of the overall revenue of the entrepreneur, then he has the only other possibility for him is to sell the company if he is not happy with it. But of course, he could sell it only for a relatively low price that would compensate the investor for this. So the investor then would earn whatever return on capital that is normal in the market. There was another question? Yeah. Yeah.
If we find loads of gold money, and that is not an arbitrary increase.
Yeah, but this is inflation, right? So it's nothing to do with deflation.
It's,
yeah.
It's like if it's an arbitrary increase, then
yes.
It's
yeah, yeah. 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 I agree. No, that's not quite correct. I mean, deflation, if it's not correctly anticipated, will lead to hiccups, right? So temporary discontinuation of production, right? But what you don't get with deflation is a systematic malinvestment of capital. So you don't get any waste of capital. You waste it. Well, you just don't use it to the full extent, right? That's what you get with deflation if you don't anticipate deflation correctly. With inflation, what you get, what you have learned, is that you get a systematic waste of capital. So you actually impoverish society. Yeah, of course. Then you get a problem, right? Then the company would go out of business. But usually, I mean, if you don't have national labor organizations, but if the local team can make autonomous decisions, then usually they see the point. I mean, we had the problem a few years ago in Germany, and they were all very reasonable. I was amazed myself, but it's really very pragmatic and say, okay, well, that's the forecast that we have of the market, and then everybody agreed on this. Okay, if this is so, then we have exactly these two choices. Either we find a better job somewhere else, or if not, well, then we accept the decline in our payments, and they did. So, of course, it's not perfect, right? There's always, but the problems that arise essentially out of the fact that you do not judge the future sufficiently well. That's essentially your problem. It's never the price level or the spending level per se. It's never the problem. Now, let's bring into play one further complication. It's just the complication. It doesn't really add something to the story, but it has some relevance in the context of a financial market meltdown. Namely, a deflationary spiral. Okay, in order to understand a deflationary spiral, let us consider a typical balance sheet of a company. So we have here the assets and the liabilities, and here we have equity, and here we have the liabilities, and we have various assets here, and we have cash balances here. Okay, now, as far as the financial market is concerned, it's important to keep in mind, or it's important to know, before you can keep in mind, that the industry is heavily intertwined. So lots of dealings occur between investment funds and banks and other players on the financial markets. So the typical situation that you have is then to have, for example, here in this case, you have two companies, and part of the assets of this company, this would be the company B, and this is company A. Part of the assets of company A are the liabilities of company B. The other way around. Right? So some of the liabilities of company A are the assets of company B. Right? B has given a credit, for example, to A. So what this means now is that if A goes bankrupt, what does it happen if A goes bankrupt? Well, it means that the value of their assets is lower than anticipated. For example, the price level has decreased, right? Let's say, for example, this diminishes to this point. Okay, so this is eaten up. Then, as a consequence, the balance as a whole is shrinking. The balance now looks like, well, I need to give you a numerical figure. That's probably the easiest way. Let's say this was 95 before, okay, and this was 5, and here we had 20 and 80, okay. Now we have a reduction of the value of the assets from 95 to, let's say, 55, okay. Very dramatic deflation. And as a consequence, the overall value of the balance sheet is no longer 100, but 60. 60 is the monetary value of everything that the bank or that this company owns. On the other side, it has liabilities of 80. So even if you sell everything, you're not able to pay back your debt. You are bankrupt. Okay? No more equity. Not only all the equity has been eaten up, but it's not even possible to pay back all the debt. What this means is that the creditors won't get back all their money. That is, their assets have to be adjusted now as well. Okay, so let's say these assets, they were they were 95, and here we had 5, equity was 10, liability was 90. So 95 needs to be adjusted to 75. Okay, total value of the whole thing is 80. Our liabilities are 90, so we are also bankrupt. Right? So this is a balance sheet illustration of the domino effect. Very nasty thing. And the domino effect is, of course, all the more likely the lower is your equity. Equity is the financial buffer that prevents the bankruptcy of any customer or any client to spread over to your own company. Right? By the way, well, we could go in more detail, but we'll leave it here. So equity is the buffer. The lower the equity is, the more fragile your company becomes. There is now an incentive for each company to reduce equity as much as possible in order to create some leverage. Let's say this company makes 20 units of profit. Okay, 20 profit. Then before the 20 profit, were remunerating 20 units of equity, so it was 100% return on equity. Okay, so it's very substantial. Let's say you reduce your equity from 20 to 5, if you reduce it from 20 to 5, and you still make 20 profit, then you thereby have increased your return on equity from 100% to 400%. Okay, so the lower is your equity, the stronger is the leverage that exists, and that increases the return on your equity. So why doesn't everybody just reduce their equity to 1% or something? Well, because it's a very risky thing to do, right? You become more fragile, so you have an interest in not doing this. Why do they do it on the financial markets? Well, because they think they have their big brother, the central bank, behind them. Nothing can happen to us, so we can reduce our equity. That's the reason why equity rates are very, very low, especially on financial markets. There's no other industry in which the equity ratios are so low. Okay, look at shoe production or car manufacturers and so on. It's not comparable. It's a typical, let's say, medium-sized company has equity ratio of 50%, 60%. If you go to larger industries, car manufacturers and so on, it's equity of 30%. If you go to the financial industries, the big banks typically operating around 2 or 3%. 2 or 3% equity ratio. So you can imagine that you're extremely vulnerable to this kind of thing. And that's exactly what has taken place since July of 2007, right? They've been all swept away in this thing. So why does this cause then a spiraling deflation? Well, in the case of banks, we need to consider that these liabilities here, what is this? Well, it's in the case of deposit banks, so commercial banks, it's checking deposits that they have created. Okay, these liabilities, not all of them, a great chunk of this, are the checking deposits created for their customers. So if a bank goes bankrupt, then of course all this year disappears. And that is part of the money supply. Right? The bank goes bankrupt, its checking deposits lose all value. Nobody is willing to accept a check drawn on that bank anymore. Okay, so the money supply shrinks, and the next company goes bankrupt, next bank goes bankrupt, the money supply shrinks even more, and so on and so on and so on. Right? So you get a spiraling deflation in which one bankruptcy entails not only the bankruptcy of other banks, but an decreasing money supply. Right? Now the question is, where does this lead to? According to our Keynesian friends, it leads into the black hole of the economy. Right? Nothing ever gets you out of a spiraling deflation. Right? Usually when they say, well, when they talk about deflation, there's always this menacing look in their eyes. Oh, deflation, yeah. We need a central, we need our friends to protect us from this. But then there's only one hyperbole beyond this. This is spiraling deflation. Then you're really in the ground and it goes right through into the center of the earth or something. Vanish. Now, that's not true. Okay. The spiraling deflation has a stopping point because it affects only a part of the money supply. It affects only that part of the money supply that is produced by banks. But there's another part of the money supply, namely base money, okay, which is not produced by commercial banks, but which in a gold standard, for example, is the gold stock itself, and which in a fiat money system is the money produced by the central banks. Central banks cannot go bankrupt. Okay, try to redeem something, nominal liability of the central bank. You take, well, this is the nominal liability of the central bank. This, okay, this is the liability of the central bank. Now go with this to the central bank and say, I would like to have my money. They will not even understand what you mean. Right? And actually, it doesn't make much sense what you say then, right? Right. This is money. Paper money is precisely that. It's something that you cannot redeem in something more fundamental. Right? As a consequence, central banks, even if their liabilities, if there's no more equity left, they cannot go bankrupt. They are not bankrupt. Right? Because this liability is a fictional liability. It's not a liability in the real sense. as it would hold for other companies. So, bottom line, the money created by central banks is not threatened by the deflation. Okay, so there is a rock bottom. As soon as the economy reaches that level of expenditure, and therefore that price level that is defined by the remaining money supply, the base money, the spiraling stops. There's no more spiraling going on. Okay, and then the economy rebuilds from there. Once you have reached this minimal level of expenditure, beyond which you cannot go because there's still money around, there's no more bankruptcy. There's just companies are being taken over by others and they're being run again. So, again, same conclusion. We have just introduced another complication, but the conclusion is still the same. Deflation, even if it's a spiraling deflation, right, is of course a very nasty thing, but it is not the end of the world. Right? From an economic point of view, it does not threaten in the medium and long run the viability of the company, of the economy, the functioning of the market economy. So what is the real significance of deflation? Why is there so much fuss about it? Well, essentially because deflation kicks a lot of butt. And a lot of people are losing their position of eminence. All the entrepreneurs, all those who were the directors, presidents, CEOs, etc., of these companies, owners, they lose their position. And they are being replaced by people who are not in debt, but who have just saved a lot of money. Okay? And that's what they don't like. And our government doesn't like deflation because it reduces the potential of financing expenditure through debt. Because in that situation, of course, the banks no longer want to give debt. And therefore, everybody goes crazy right now in Germany and in France. Right? The government has bailed out all the banks. Now the banks refuse to lend. Imagine that. They're quite happy. We are safe. Yeah, you've got to lend more, especially to us. So the governments don't like this. Right? So deflation is not an economic problem. It's essentially a sociological and political problem. That's the true significance of deflation. It threatens the elites, the economical, political elites of a country. No. There's another complication, right? We don't have a course. I cannot do a full course. I would like to give for you guys a course during the week or something. I would have to have about three more lectures or something. We could do all of this. So again, there the bottom line. We can consider all these cases, and you're right, right? That the deflation will have unequal impact on the different companies. But the bottom line is, right, from the overall point of view, there's not more, let's say, additional bankruptcy that is entailed by these redistributive effects than under a normal operating economy. Okay, so that's the basic argument. Okay, so with this in mind, we have a few minutes. I will just talk about a few critiques of deflation. They are still prevalent. So I have here my list, the historical record of deflation. Second, deflation postpones spending and therefore paralyzes the economy. Third, deflation prevents serving debt. We had this in a way. Fourth is deflation creates banking crisis and therefore a curtailment of credit. And fifth would be sticky prices. Sixth would be nominal interest rates can no longer be diminished. And seventh, okay, is another point. Well, I'll go through my list. Okay, so the first thing is, as a matter of historical fact, there's no systematic relationship between the price level and medium to long run growth. Okay, you look at that's something that mainstream economists have done. There's an article published in the 2004 American Journal, American Economic Review, by two mainstream economists who have studied these correlations and found out that there is no such thing. There's no empirical link between deflation and growth. And they were surprised themselves by this. Right? So about 2003 was a new interest in deflation studies and so on, so that was an outgrowth of this. So if you take a long-run view and study the major periods of deflation, some of them were actually periods of very strong growth. And the strongest growth rates that we ever had in Germany were in the last quarter of the 19th century, in a period that was called the Great Depression at the time. That is, until the 1930s, when we really had the Great Depression, right? But until then, so during the 1900s and through the 1920s, this was called the Great Depression, the period from 1872 to 1896.
And because we were, all the companies were operating in an environment of strongly falling consumer prices and even strongly falling producer goods prices. The only prices that did not fall very much were wages, okay, which is interesting. It also shows that this was a period of very strong increases of real wage rates, because if all prices fall and your wage rates remain by and large stable, it means that you grow richer every year. Right? And in the US, by the way, it was the same thing. The strongest growth rates that this country has ever had were also in the same period, last quarter of the 19th century. Same thing, falling, strongly falling consumer CPI level, and strongly falling consumer goods prices. So deflationary environment, very strong growth rates. The historical record does not say anything against deflation, rather for it. And this, by the way, might we say, also holds true not only in what some economists call benign deflation, that is, if inflation results from stronger real growth rates, but also in the case of vicious deflation, when deflation results from falling money supply, as in the case of banking crisis. Right? So banking crisis, of course, create hiccups. Right? It's a nasty thing. It's like a sickness for an individual. Right? For some time, you're out of order. You lie in bed and so on. You don't do much. But it's the sickness, as the sickness is necessary for the recovery and recovered health of the individual. So a good banking crisis from time to time is necessary just to purge the banking system, get all the bad guys out, and put the whole system on a more sound basis. So even there, right, even the so-called vicious deflation is not a vicious deflation. It's a very socially useful deflation. Second point, a postponement of spending. That's a typical Keynesian concern, of course. And what they say is the following. If you know that prices decrease every month or every year, then you have an incentive not to spend your money now, but to wait until you get the stuff cheaper. Right? You don't buy your coffee now, you wait until next week until you can buy. You don't buy your car now, but you wait until next week or next month or so on. So as a consequence, of course, this can also lead to a spiraling hyperdeflation, because as you decrease your spending, then of course there's an additional push on prices. Right? So prices fall even stronger. You have an even stronger incentive not to buy anything now. So spiraling, blah, and you again, right, you reach the center of the earth and you vanish. So what's wrong with this argument? Well, the first thing is that, of course, there would be no such spiraling going on for two reasons, two limits to this. First of all, few people are faeces, okay? And even faeces need to eat and consume something at some point of time. So there is a minimum level of the expenditure absolutely necessary for people just to keep on living. And you cannot go beyond this level physically. That's what economists call the constraint of the stomach. Cannot go beyond this. Second, even if we abstract from this, right, we are no faeces and so on, then most people would like to experience the life of a faqir and just have just bare minimum consumption for whatever, 1 month or even one week. Most people have what Austrians call a time preference, okay, a positive time preference. They prefer the enjoyment of things sooner rather than later, okay? So there are lots of things. I mean, next week the coffee will be 10 cents cheaper. So therefore, I'm holding back. This is ridiculous, right? Same thing for cars. There might be another $1,000 cheaper next year. So I tell my family, okay, we go on riding our bicycles to Florida. This is ridiculous, right? So there would be a lot of spending actually going on. And the bottom line, therefore, is that spending in a deflationary environment would be reduced. That's true. And the obvious question then is, so what? What's so bad about this? I mean, it's not that Austrian economists are in favor of it. That would be a value judgment, right? That you say, well, I prefer less consumption and higher saving rates. Okay, that's a different thing. But I mean, from an overall point of view, what's so bad about this actually? All it means, well, you consume less and there's more money available that is saved, so more available for investment, so the economy will have higher growth rates. All kinds of things that you can do that you would not have been able to do in the absence of the deflation. Fakir. F-A-K-I-R.
You know, the Indian guys are sitting on the needle bed. Yeah. Yeah. It's a minimum mass subsistence living, right? You know, you're living, you're already in the clouds somewhere, right? It's just your body is just a little appendage to your mind that is already, it's become almost independent, right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. If you have strong growth rates, yes. Because, again, it's a technical argument. Of course, the money supply would also increase. It's, I mean, we had this arrow here, right? So if we say this is the investment of a money producer, a gold miner, right? So the gold miner, he churns out whatever, let's say 100 ounces of gold. Okay, this is his physical product. It's not the thing that he, because money, gold is the money in this economy, so he doesn't sell gold as against something else, which would be the money. He produces money itself. Okay, now he pays his factors of production, he pays them whatever, 70. Okay. If you have a deflation, then the payments for the factors of production will decrease, maybe to 60 ounces, but you would still have the same physical product, 100 ounces. Okay, so you see, there's a greater profit in a deflation, therefore, mine production would be increased. But because the returns on the physical returns are, of course, diminishing, right, the increase of the money supply is never quite as high as the decrease of the price level. So it will never completely neutralize the decrease of the price. It would be a secular tendency toward falling prices. Yeah.
Is it possible that the reason why in the past, you know, we had gold rushes and they had such a negative effect, a market money system, what we had was a gold standard. So it demanded, okay, use this money. This actually damaged the pure market system you could have. You could take advantage of the expectations of the most wanting to account for this factor.
Yeah. Other questions?
Is it possible that...
Yeah, that's the great concern right now, right? Yeah.
So
but
you have deflation in effect.
No, I mean, the problem, well, it's a little bit more complicated. They have a double problem. On the one hand, that's the overall aim, right? They want to prevent that the level of spending diminishes. This they could very simply do by just pumping the money through other channels, but the financial markets, right? They could just start buying things or handing out more money directly to the government. There's nothing that technically prevents that you just send a lorry from the central bank to the treasury department, right? So why don't they do this? Well, because most of the money is actually being produced by the banking system. So you also need, as a secondary objective, you need to save the banking industry. That's more tricky if you have to lend them money, right? So then you need to be inventive. But of course, I mean, technically, again, you could just make a very generous donation. Why lend them money? Of course, politically, it would be disastrous, right? It would mean that, in fact, the company, the country is entirely hijacked to be slaves of the banking. They don't even have to serve the debt anymore. But technically, it's of course possible. You could just hand them out the money, say, here you guys, and survive and thrive, right? Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the question has already been answered at the beginning of the week by Doug French in his lecture. There is no such thing as an optimal money supply. Or more precisely, all quantities of money are equally optimal. No, that would not... Those are very good questions, right? That, it would not follow from it, right? Just would you, if you had a free market, then money production would be a business just as any other business as well. And they would produce more money. And the additional amounts of money would just be as optimal. The new money supply that is now higher would just be as optimal as the previous money supply. Well, yeah. Well, one social benefit to be derived from this is what you find in the Austrian literature is that consumer demands for example, jewelry and so on would be satisfied. That's one point. And I think there's a second point that also needs to be stressed, because as you increase the money supply, of course, you prevent that the coin size drops too much. Right? If deflation, if you have very strong deflation, let's say with a gold coinage, then the gold coins become ever more, their purchasing power ever more increases. So it becomes then impossible to use them in actually daily practice. No, precisely, because if in a natural monetary system you have some ongoing production of money, silver coins in particular, also gold coins, and this prevents that this technological problem appears. Thank you for your attention. See you later.